Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Girl, real talk. This whole, it's new year, time to reinvent myself trash is not the vibe for 2024. You can find someone who loves you for you, as you are. You don't need to read a stack of self-help books, only eat sad salads, or like start meditating at 5 a.m. to be ready for dating. So yeah, my advice is to download Bumble and find someone who embraces you the way you are right now. Let me know how it goes.
I was fairly clear on the fact that I was never going to make money off my writing. That hasn't turned out to be true, but that is definitely what reality felt like to me 15, 20 years ago. Was I better have a day job. And the upside of that was that my writing was all play for me.
I'm Jordan Kissner, author of the essay collection Thin Places, and this is Thresholds, a weekly series of conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they wrote afterward. Yule Abyss is, I think, one of the great essayists working today. She's the author of several awarded works of nonfiction, including Notes from No Man's Land, On Immunity, and most recently her book Having and Being Had, which is a series of short meditations on the complicated relationship between work, labor, art, value, and capital. That sounds pretty high-flown, maybe, and it is, but the book feels really approachable and very grounded in everyday moments like talking to neighbors, speaking up in a work meeting, deciding whether to do this or that repair on your house. It's conversational and it's searching, and one of the things I appreciate about it is the way she illuminates the small manners in which we're all always navigating the question of what gives our work and our lives value. She chatted with me about a big decision about her work she made after finishing the book, which she's still feeling her way through.
I've realized in thinking about this that my life is just full of thresholds, transformations, times, liminal states, times of transition. It's like, I think I live there. I live in the threshold, and I think I've lived there for a long time. And as a writer, I think I actually court this state that you're talking about. And maybe we can eventually get there talking in the more abstract sense about like how a writer arrives at this kind of liminal, transitional, transformational place. But more concretely, I think my most recent book came out of crossing over a threshold, moving through a threshold. And that was kind of a class threshold. Not that I changed classes, but that I moved into living a fairly some version of what we imagine to be a conventional middle-class lifestyle. So that hadn't been true for most of my adulthood. And then I held down a steady job for a while, had a kid and bought a house. And it was really buying the house and moving into it that felt like a major moment of transition for me around how I was living and experiencing my class. So it's not that I suddenly became middle class. It's more that I entered this middle class lifestyle. And I had a lot of thoughts and feelings about it. So this most recent book, Having and Being Had, really came out of that moment where I was watching myself. I was observing this lifestyle, which for the moment was strange to me because I was new to it. It's a lifestyle that isn't strange to a lot of people because it's, you know, it's broadcast all over the place, and, you know, in media and television as the supposedly normative American lifestyle, even though most people don't live it. So there are things about it that could be familiar, but I felt like a little bit of a stranger in a strange land when I arrived in this place. And so part of the project of the book was kind of anthropological notes on what this lifestyle is, what mindset accompanies it, what its expectations and assumptions are. And so I think that was the project of the book, is something of a cultural critique of the middle class. The decision to buy a house was made with my partner over a fairly long period of conversation, years. We were living in an apartment building in Chicago and had a young child who was annoying all our neighbors, or at least our downstairs neighbors, just by, you know, moving around, living. His living was annoying our neighbors. But, you know, I think buying a house meant something fairly different to me than it meant to my partner. We have different class backgrounds, different mindsets, different everything. But so we did go back and forth, and we spent a fair amount of time looking and not being able to find something that we could afford in a distance that would be walkable or bikeable to where we work. And that was one of the things we were looking for. And so so it took a long time. It took like four years or more for us to find a house. And during that time period, I started to not really want a house anymore. It took us long enough to find one that by the time we found one, I was like, I might be finished with this idea. I don't need a house after all. But, you know, this was not just me alone making this decision. It was in conversation with my partner, and he had quite a bit of enthusiasm for the house that we eventually found. And it's not like I was dragged into it. I was excited too, but I'd had long enough to think about it that I was, by the time we signed the paperwork, I was beginning to think about what we were trading for, the various ways in which this house would make our lives easier. And it did make our lives easier almost immediately. But, you know, we did trade something for that as well. The mortgage locked us into needing a certain level of income.
Yeah. And in the book, you write pretty explicitly about your mixed feelings about that.
Yeah.
About how the cost of the gift you had been able to give yourselves sometimes felt really high. There was a moment in, I guess, later in the book where you talk about feeling like your job, which you now certainly need, is robbing the pleasure from your work.
Yeah.
And that was one of the prices of this home that also made your life easier.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. The buying the house and taking on a mortgage put me to a different relationship to my work life in general, but that job specifically. And I think it focused my attention on ways in which I already felt confined or trapped by that job. It's once I really needed it, had to have it, a lot more of my attention went to the ways in which it was confining me, I guess, or not right for me. But, you know, that for me, even just talking about work is complicated because work means so many things in my life. So I had a job teaching, which I no longer have. But I also had my work as a writer, and I use work to refer to both of those things. But for most of my adult life, my work as a writer has not provided any sort of steady income. It's provided occasional windfalls of money, but especially for the first 15 years or so of my writing life, I wasn't, you know, it wasn't paying the rent for sure.
The amount of attention you pay in having and being had to definitions and to trying to find definitions or clear meanings to words that we all sort of agree on vague definitions of. You ask a friend, what is capitalism? You talk about the definition of work versus labor versus job. You question the word luxury. And I'm curious why this emphasis on looking directly at these words and trying to unpack the word itself felt so important to you in this project.
Yeah, I think it's because I was going through a period in my life where I was asking myself really frequently what I want, what I really want. And in order to answer that question, I had to know what the terms I was using meant, you know, at least for my own purposes, you know. So when I was asking myself, what do I want out of work? What do I want out of my work life? I need to know what work means. In what sense am I using that word? Even when I say work, do I mean my writing? When I say work, do I mean the teaching that I do for income? And the same for pretty much everything in this moment, which is, you know, I'm writing through in this book something of a midlife crisis, right? Which is its own threshold, right? It's a liminal, transitional, if you're lucky, transformational place. And in this moment of crisis, the ground seems to be shifting under me, and every question I ask seems to involve a quantity that I can't define. So that's partly I'm asking myself, what is my relationship to capitalism? And what's my place in it? But in order to answer that question, I need to know, what is capitalism? What am I talking about here? So, you know, and this is part of the way the book really circles certain definitions and certain concepts. So the three terms that repeat in the headings of the short works that make up this longer work are capitalism, work, and art. And this is me returning again and again to my own questions about what those things are. What is work? What is capitalism? And what is art to me? And I'm returning again and again because I'm asking myself, what do I want these things to be? And if am I in a moment in my life where I can invite these things to have a certain kind of presence in my life, or can I reimagine my relationship to these things? I think that's what's really going on in this book, is I'm beginning to wonder, can I reimagine my relationship to work? Can I reimagine my relationship to capitalism, to art making? And You know, I think, as I mentioned to you, I think that I more or less live in a threshold, in that I have a lot of negative capability. I dwell in ambivalence. I'm really comfortable in contradiction, internal contradiction. I spend a lot of time in that psychological space. I think that that's why I'm attracted to the essay as a writer. It's a genre that's especially amenable to that mindset. It's especially fertile for ambivalence, uncertainty, second guessing, the open exploration of questions. So that's my sense of the genre, and it's also why I'm here as a writer. So now I've lost my train of thought.
This episode of Thresholds is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service showing exceptional films from around the world. Every day, Mubi premieres a new film. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there's always something new to discover. And each and every film is hand-selected. It's like your own personal film festival, streaming anytime, anywhere. Something I particularly love about Mubi is the way that they create collections of films, like highlights from past years of the Cannes Film Festival, or films that emphasize the history of French feminist filmmaking. You can try Mubi for free for 30 days at Mubi.com/thresholds. That's Mubi.com/thresholds for a whole month of great cinema for free. Be sure to check what's streaming in your area.
Well, it's just, I keep losing my train of thought because this is such interesting, fertile, exciting ground for me, this thresholds question. It just branches in so many directions for me. It branches into my actual practice as a writer and into some of these specifics of genre, but also the way I use research and what research does for me on the page and what it does for my process. So, you know, my mind was just starting to wander in that direction, but it also, you know, connects to, I think, something that I'm now beginning to understand that I invite in my own life as well. You know, I invite this state of uncertainty and ambivalence. I thought for a long time that I was on my way to some kind of arrival as a writer or as a person. And I think I'm just beginning to make peace with the fact that there will be no arrival, and in part because I won't allow it. And I won't allow it because some part of me understands that would be artistically devastating. So I've got to keep myself in this very unsettling and, you know, to some extent unstable place, but that is also really artistically generative. So one of the things that isn't, that happened after the narrative time of this book, Having and Being Had, but I think the book was very much building towards this decision, is that I quit my job shortly after finishing this book. And now that I've done that and left my teaching job, I think in my mind, that's the real conclusion to the work. I think that quitting that act was the real ending of the book. It's not in the book. The book is very open-ended, but I think it's open-ended because the true ending hadn't happened yet when I finished the book. The real ending was that I decided to quit this job and propel myself into another, you know, moment of threshold crossing, where now I've left that teaching position that I was in for 15 years and am now in a pretty open-ended amorphous space where I'm trying to figure out if and how I can make my living as a writer, which I've never done in my adult life.
Wow. How did you make that decision?
I think I made it, the how of it is I made it through writing that book, you know, through turning over all these questions about what is work in my life? What do I want work to be? And what can work be? And I think I made the decision to leave this teaching job in order to open some new possibilities for what work could be in my life. I think I'm hoping for both something a little more expansive in terms of using what I have to offer, but also, I think I had a sense, you know, past 40, that I was arriving at a place where whatever work I was doing, I needed to be in a decision-making role. This sense that I'd arrived at a place in my life, in my development as a writer, but also in my own relationship to being a working woman, where I just couldn't continue on in a workspace where I didn't have a meaningful voice in a decision-making role in my workplace. And I didn't have that in my job. So that's really what propelled me out the door. And now, you know, I've got a lot of decisions to make. It's, I've got the other problem now. All the decisions are mine.
Right. When did you quit your job? Like, when did that happen?
This past spring. So it hasn't been that long. I resigned in March or April. Yeah. Yeah. That long at all.
How's it going? How does it feel?
It felt exhilarating at first. And now I think some of the exhilaration has worn off, and it feels a little, there's a little uneasiness has crept in that because I haven't quite located the next thing. And so I'm in a very much a transitional period where I'm trying out a few different things and trying out collaborations with other writers, trying out doing some of the work that I loved in teaching. So mentorship and looking at other people's writing, doing manuscript consultation. I'm trying to do some of that outside the structure of an institution. And so it's tricky, actually, this place that I'm in I'm trying to keep doing the things that I loved about teaching without a teaching job. But I'm also, you know, part of this decision was about opening up more time for my own writing and for my creative work. And that is also both exhilarating and scary. It's, I think the thing that I didn't have the luxury of understanding for many, many years is that being too busy to attend to your own writing saves you from some of the terror of facing down your own work, you know? So right. I was always, for many, many years, I was just writing in the cracks and crevices, you know, I was writing in the time left over. I was writing mostly at night, you know, I wrote several books mostly at night. and so this is really fairly new for me that I get to write in the daytime. And that I get to write on, you know, what would be a working schedule for most people on something approaching a 9-to-5 schedule. That's brand new and really great, tremendous luxury, but also, you know, having more time opens up space for different kinds of ambition. And then I have to reckon with my own ambition and wrestle with it a little bit. And so this is also a time that's a little bit, I don't know. I am experiencing a little more struggle around my own artistic practice than I have in the past, in part because I have the time for that luxury of struggle. And I didn't in the past.
Sure. I mean, to an extent also, you've by getting rid of the job that mm-hmm. was sort of the most vexed aspect of your relationship to your work or your labor, depending on mm-hmm. which word you would choose to use.
Yeah.
And putting writing and art making at the center mm-hmm. of your working life. You've shifted. I mean, as somebody who's just written this big, long book about capitalism and productivity and work and art and trying to solve that, mm-hmm. it does. I mean, it seems like a great triumph in a way. That seems like, yeah, the great ending of the book that isn't in the book, that you quit this job and mm-hmm. so that you can make more art. And yet I wonder how it feels to put more financial pressure, more capital pressure on your art making.
Yeah. And, you know, that was the thing that I was most worried about when I was in the process of making this decision. I was worried about putting earning pressure on my writing, in part because I've always enjoyed and been very aware of enjoying the fact that there was no earning pressure on my writing. In the beginning, that was just a product of the sort of writing I was doing. I started out writing mostly prose poetry and kind of odd nonfiction that wasn't, in the moment I was writing it, wasn't going to earn any money. I didn't even have the impression, 15 and 20 years ago that I just had to, work a little longer, a little harder at it as a writer, and eventually I'd start to earn money as a writer. I was fairly clear on the fact that I was never going to make money off my writing. That hasn't turned out to be true, but that is definitely what reality felt like to me 15, 20 years ago, was I better have a day job. The upside of that was that my writing was all play for me. It was a place of pure play and pleasure, which doesn't mean it wasn't also work, right? It was, my writing was where I was doing my most difficult intellectual work, asking the hardest questions. I was writing a book, for instance, about whiteness and race and about, the hardest questions I could ask myself about my own place in the world as a human being. And so that wasn't, it wasn't all fun and games, but it was also, I never thought about questions like, will this sell? And will somebody pay me for this? That was never my priority. By the time I was writing my second and third book, it didn't have to be a priority. I had a day job, I was teaching. And so it was really hard to make this decision to put a new kind of pressure on my artistic practice, that I was very aware of the fact that that could be bad for my work and bad for my practice. I also, though, was taking into consideration the fact that I'm at this point mid-career and hopefully developed enough as a writer that I know what I want to do and I know how I want to sound. And I think I'm stubborn enough to maybe now be strong enough to tolerate some earning pressure on my work. You're asking me this question in a moment of real experimentation. Really, what I'm doing now is trying out, what will it feel like, and what will happen to the work when there's earning pressure on it. And initially, it didn't feel good. And I was really prepared for the arrival of this new kind of pressure, I was a little caught off guard by how bad it felt, And I think some things remain the same. And this is one of the things that I've learned from talking to other writers who do make their living or do pay the rent from their writing, is many of them do have two categories of writing in their minds, that the writing that they're the earning writing and the writing that is really their creative work. You know, even if those two categories aren't necessarily discernible to readers, they are to the writer. The writer knows, you know, this one's for me or this one's for money. You know?
Yeah, yeah, that distinction of this I am writing for myself.
Yes.
Even if you eventually sell it.
Yes.
Or have sold it always. Like there, you know, that's a...
Yes.
That distinction is also one I keep for myself and have heard other people talk mm-hmm. about too.
Yes.
Is that already present in your thinking or are you trying to approach it in a different way?
No, it is very much present. And it is, as you say, a fairly constant negotiation. So, you know, one of the things that made this last book, Having and Being Had, you know, almost a work of performance art, you know, there was a lot going on beyond the page, was that this was the first work that I ever sold on proposal before finishing the writing. So I sold on immunity for a small amount of money when it was mostly finished. So that one was, I think, maybe technically sold on proposal, but not like Having Me Being Had, which was a book that really wasn't even close to done when I sold it. And so I was in this place where part of me felt like I'd pulled off some sort of coup as a writer in that I had the money in my pocket already and, you know, and, which wasn't true for my first three books, you know, the time that it took to write those books was I paid out of my own, you know, scrambling and ingenuity and grants that I got and various ways of, getting money and getting time. And with this book, I more or less was paid up front. And so this should have, I believe, put me in a place where I was utterly free to do whatever I wanted, right? It's, but I found myself very aware that I was getting paid more for this book than I'd ever been paid for any of my other work. And I think I started imagining the kind of book that I'd have to write to have earned my advance. And I kept falling short in my mind of writing that book. And so I was in some kind of really strange psychological muddle where I kept failing to write the book that would be worth the money I'd been paid, which is maybe just a version of what we all go through as writers with just every book I've written has failed to live up to some kind of expectation that I've had for it. So this time that expectation was tied to money in a new way. But I know I've never quite written the book that I set out to write with any of my books. So it was a new version of that. But I guess I've also never been... dogged by concerns like, will this sell? That's actually never crossed my mind with a book until this time. And it confused me a little bit because I thought, why does it matter to me? If it sells or not, I've been paid.
Right. Well, I mean, it sounds like you were feeling the pressure of having been invested in, right?
Yes.
Like the thing about the selling a book on advance is that the publisher has determined that they're prepared to invest X amount of money in you mm-hmm. because they think what you make will return on their investment.
Yes.
So there is a kind of an obligation, even if it's not real, you know,
yes.
they're not going to make you give the money back if your book doesn't earn out.
Yeah.
But there is... even if it's not written into the contract, there is, I think, maybe socially this feeling, or mm-hmm. I don't know, emotionally, this feeling mm-hmm. that what you're supposed to do is supposed to be worth the dollar amount
mm-hmm.
that they've attached to it
yes.
entirely arbitrarily, probably.
Yes.
And And that, I mean, you're reminding me of one of the short pieces in the book where you are defending the right of your writing to be worthless.
Yeah. Yeah.
And saying like, I don't want to have to make my writing be valuable in the marketplace, because mm-hmm. then there will be so little left in my life that is given the freedom to be worthless. Mm-hmm. There is a sacrifice, I think, somewhere mm-hmm. in asking your writing to be worth something, if only because you feel obligated then to make it worth mm-hmm. something. But there's no way to, like, that's a purely imaginative exercise.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There is no way to make a book worth anything in a concrete sense when mm-hmm. you're writing it.
Yes.
Or in a capitalist sense when you're writing it.
Yeah.
And so it just, I think, becomes confusing in the way that you're describing. Mm-hmm. If you're like, I'm in a weird tangle mm-hmm. where I'm trying to write something that's valuable enough, but how could the writer possibly know how to do that?
Yes, this is a great way of putting it. And I think it brings you straight to an anxiety that I think is best hidden from yourself when you're writing, the is this worth it concern. I think that concern dogs many writers, and we all find different ways of hiding from it or tamping it down, or and people suffer different versions of it. You know, some people suffer the, is the time I'm putting towards this endeavor worth it? Is this work worth someone else's attention? And, you know, I think for quite a bit of my career as a writer, I really didn't struggle that much with the, is this worth it question. I just knew that I had to write for my own purposes. It was worth it because of what I got out of it. And that really wasn't a question that I troubled with all this that much. So this was a new experience for me, is really being brought to the worth it question in a day-to-day way, where I had to find various ways of answering that question or hiding from it. But there was something in what you just said that I wanted to return to. It was really interesting to me. And now I'm trying to circle back in my mind to what it was. Yeah. Oh, I was going to go back to the worthlessness and like the value of worthlessness. And that, I think that was the contradiction that I was writing around and to and within in this book, and that I'm still in now, is this, that the worthlessness of writing is both wonderful and terrible. I think it's actually wonderful and liberating to be in a space where there's no economic value to what you're doing. But it's terrible because you're pouring time into something that can't feed you or house you. So, and that creates a constant tension between the thing that you want to be doing and the thing that you have to be doing in order to provide for yourself and your family. And that's the contradiction that I was trying to think about in this book. And I still find it interesting and fruitful to muddle around in that contradiction. And it's a contradiction that comes up around parenting for me too. It's parenting is another one of those worthless activities, right? In that people don't have children to make money. And in general, it's a money losing endeavor to have a kid. I don't know if you can say that having children is anti-capitalist, but it does put you, especially if you're the parent who is doing most of the caregiving, or a dominant amount of the caregiving, it puts you in this, the position of an artist to be doing work that is undervalued and uncompensated for the most part. And that doesn't mean there aren't pleasures in the work, right? We parent for reasons that have nothing to do with money. But it also creates tremendous hardships for people, specifically women, to have to parent without any financial compensation for that labor. And it creates horrible decisions that have to be made between providing what you think a child needs and wants and providing, you know, for their material existence, their food and housing. So it puts parents in the position of having to choose between time with their child and supporting their child's material needs. Horrible decisions.
Going around and around in my head about, like, back to this question of vocabulary and definitions, thinking about this idea of worthlessness or the right of making writing that's mm-hmm. worthless. Because it seems like one of the problems we run into, I don't know, conversationally, but certainly practically, is the fact that writing and lots of kinds of work that have to do with vocation, the feeling mm-hmm. of needing to bring something into the world, is both work and art, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, and there's a real hesitation that I feel and that you write about of making the worth of art subject to the vocabulary or the terms of capitalism or of the market, yeah. right? Of like, mm-hmm. of asking something like parenting or something like painting to be worthwhile in the same way that, I don't know, building infrastructure is worthwhile. I don't mm-hmm. know what the good sort of counter example would be, mm-hmm. but it's there's a like a gap in our language when we talk about this vexed relationship between work that's just the work you do to support yourself, like mm-hmm. it's your clock in, clock out work, and the work that is vocation that might sort of that, or the labor maybe that mm-hmm. is also vocation that you do not because it's financially sustaining you, mm-hmm. but because it's sustaining you or the world in other ways, like mm-hmm. parenting, like writing.
Yeah.
And it strikes me listening to you that missing word feels really important because what happens is that we wind up having to talk about this in the terms of the market,
yes.
and not in other terms that might be mm-hmm. feel more capacious for the truth of the situation.
Yeah. And this is one of the interesting things that came up in my research for this book, is that many languages used to have two words for work. And so English did as well. We had work and labor. And one of these words is used in many languages for the pleasurable aspects of work, or work that is pleasurable or done for its own reward. And then another word is used for work that is drudgery, or is done for is unrewarding. So but one of the interesting things is that even though many, many languages had two words to navigate the very distinction that you're talking about, in this post-industrial moment, those words have collapsed into each other. And we tend to use just one word now for both for work that is rewarding and work that is drudgery. And actually, when I really think about it, most jobs have aspects of both, right? There's rewarding aspects to many jobs and a certain element of drudgery to many jobs as well. Though, you know, then there's jobs that that definitely tilt more towards drudgery than others. Well, and this is the interesting thing in these, when I was reading Lewis Hyde and he was talking about the distinction between work and labor, as he uses those terms, and he's defining, I think it's labor. Now I've confused the two, but I think he's defining labor as pleasurable work. And for him, part of what the defining characteristic of labor is that it's transformative. And so I'm bringing this up because it brings us back to thresholds, right? And this and transformation is and he gives this list of work that could be considered labor. And his list includes like inventing a new equation, writing a poem, parenting a child, providing psychoanalysis, you know, all these things offer some promise of transformation. And in reading that list, I realized, oh yes, yeah, this is all the work that I'm attracted to. Parenting, writing, teaching is work that offers tremendous opportunity for transformation. And in that way is really luxurious work. Because the ratio of drudgery to transformation is really excellent in a lot of those endeavors. I do think quite a good number of writers and artists are able to hide out in academia and have really stable positions that are rewarding and satisfying for them, and that also provide the financial stability that they need to do their work as artists. So I do think it tends to be, of the many options available to writers and artists, I think it tends to be one of both the most stable and the most lucrative out there. But I do think there's a possibility that the relationship was always going to be vexed for me, just because I think as much as I crave stability for reasons that are totally personal and have to do with my own childhood and background, I think I'm realizing that certain kinds of instability are what I write from and are really creatively generative for me. And so I either have to dwell in instability or I have to find ways to generate intellectual instability or intellectual discomfort, and which I'm pretty good at doing, I have to say. You know, it's one of the ways I do that as a writer is by putting myself in subject matter that I'm uncomfortable with and unprepared to tackle. And one of the things I've discovered is that I'm just not the kind of writer who's ever going to have a subject matter that I land on and become an expert in and write book after book about. It's in part because I need to be destabilized by my lack of knowledge in a particular area in order to be driven into the creative process the way that I like to engage with it. So, you know, writing a book about vaccination when I had very little background in even the sciences in general was really destabilizing for me and nerve-wracking and difficult, but it was also incredibly artistically productive. And I think the way that I've been destabilizing myself lately is by setting intellectual challenges that are going to be hard to meet. So this book, Having and Being Had, is actually part of a two-book project I've been envisioning these two books for quite a while. And I knew that the first book would be more personal in nature. And now I'm working on the second book, which is more outward focused. And I'm looking at some of the same questions about capitalism and property and ownership and work and money. But I'm trying to look at those questions in an international setting and with a scope that I have not used in my work before. So I'm writing a collection of essays where I look at land ownership and property rights in rural England, in South Africa, in various places in the United States, but also in countries that I don't know that much about, including Japan is one of the places I'm considering writing about. And so this is just pushing me far out of my knowledge base and comfort zone. And of course, there's all kinds of, problems and pitfalls that could be created for me as a writer because of that. But I think it's also what keeps me being in a place where I feel like I need to learn a lot fast and where I don't have the context that I need, and I need to stretch and reach to find that context. I think that that's what puts me in the place that I write from and where I feel most artistically productive. So that's, I think that that's something that I'm continually doing, is finding ways to destabilize myself with subject matter.
That's just the most essayisty.
It turns out I'm really an essayist.
You're really super duper an essayist. Thresholds is a production of Lit Hub Radio. We're produced by Drew Broussard and Justin Alvarez. Music and editing by Laura Faye Oshwood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Kirsten Huber. Special thanks to Farrar, Strauss, and Drew. I'm Jordan Kistner. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jordan.kistner. We'll see you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.